I'm Steve Potter, and welcome to Cityscape. Later, an interview with musicians Jeff and David Lazaroff of the Brothers Lazaroff about this year's Hanukkah Hullabaloo. And we'll also preview the 12th annual Baby Blues Showcase that features some of the country's leading up-and-coming blues musicians. We begin with a new book, The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. It tells the history of this country in a unique and fascinating way. The book is filled with enlightening backstories and photographs. The book was put together by Richard Curran, the Smithsonian Institution's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture. He's a cultural anthropologist who serves as the Smithsonian's liaison to the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities and the White House Historical Association. Richard Curran, welcome to Cityscape.
Well, it's great to be here, Steve.
This is a big book, well over 700 pages, and the objects are a variety of things, everything from Dizzy Gillespie's trumpet to George Custer's jacket to Dorothy's ruby shoes, as well as some objects that have ties to St. Louis here that we'll get to in a minute. So what was your inspiration for this project?
Well, there was a fellow, Neil McGregor, who runs the British Museum. He did a book 2 years ago called 100 Objects of World History, using the collections of the British Museum. And it was a big hit. And the publishers of that called me, and I had written some other work. I've worked for the Smithsonian since 1976. And they said, how about doing one on American history? And I thought, well, Americans, you know, we don't study history that much in the schools anymore. We're a much more diverse country than we ever were. So I thought history was important to do. Besides, I'm married to a school teacher who told me to do it.
So you had to.
I had to. But I had one condition. The condition was, you know, Neil did 100 objects of world history. I said, we're Americans. We need 101.
Got to top it. We were speaking a few minutes before we started this interview, and you just happened to mention when we're talking about your book that in the course of this project that you learned a lot, which sort of surprised me.
Yeah. Well, look, nobody's an expert in the whole range of American history and all the topics that run from scientific inventions to government. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot by going to exhibits in the Smithsonian, reading a lot, and also listening very closely to my curators and scholars at the Smithsonian, who are the real experts. So if this old dog could learn from having worked for the Smithsonian for several decades, I think many people will be enlightened by the book and surprised what they do learn.
Well, you're the Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture for the Smithsonian. So can you explain what that role is briefly and how it relates to this project?
Sure. I oversee most of the museums of the Smithsonian, all the history museums, you know, our American History Museum, American Indian Museum, all our art museums, National Portrait Gallery, and so on, a lot of our educational and cultural programs. So I kind of look at myself. I used to play football. I'm the downfield blocker for the Smithsonian. I help directors of the museums and programs do their bit in terms of budget, in terms of the logistic support and everything else they need. But I'm also a scholar, trained as an anthropologist, have a deep interest in American history, culture, art, and so on. So provide some expertise and some guidance to my fellow colleagues at the Smithsonian.
There are literally millions of objects in the Smithsonian's collections. Can you ballpark that?
Yeah, 137 million, not an easy number. And that's not photographs. We think about 20 million of those. And then archives that would stretch a good bit out of the planet and back if you line them up.
Well, then how did you choose 101?
Not easily, I'll tell you. You know, the what I did first is I went to our curators, I went to our different museums, and I said, make your suggestions. And everybody has their favorite. And as you might expect, the folks at the National Postal Museum, they're partial to stamps. So, you know, they suggested like 100 stamps. And the portrait gallery people suggested portraits, and everybody had their suggestions. So I took those. The other thing I did is I looked at the carpet in the Smithsonian museums. That is, where's the carpet worn down?
I mean, literally?
Well, figuratively. Where do people go when they come to the Smithsonian? We get 30 million visitors a year. Where's the carpet worn out? That is, what do people gravitate to? And so they want to see George Washington's sword. They want to see Neil Armstrong's spacesuit, the Star-Spangled Banner, Lincoln's hat, and even Kermit the Frog. So, you know, those are popular items. So I looked at that, and then I picked out some items that have never been on exhibit at the Smithsonian. They maybe tell some of the backstory. They're not that well known, but they help fill out the picture of our country.
Well, I just picked out some at random.
Okay.
So let me throw some at you. One of the objects that's featured early on in the book is a portrait of Christopher Columbus. I think there are actually three likenesses of him. Mm-hmm. But the first, it looks like a woodcut to me.
Mm-hmm.
So could you describe that and explain how that object opens the door to the whole backstory?
Well, I think, you know, when we think about what some people call the discovery of America, certainly from a European perspective, Columbus opened up the door, although he never came to the mainland. It was in the Caribbean. And there's a lot of speculation about Columbus. Did he know to what extent did he know what he was doing and so on? I think, you know, Columbus remains somewhat of an enigmatic figure. We don't quite know what he looked like because there really is no great credible a portrait of him while he was alive. So just like a lot of countries argue over who was Columbus and who gets credit for the so-called discovering America, I think the issue of what he looked like is important. Now, this woodcut shows him in a distant glare, you know, gaze, and people have speculated whether he was losing his eyesight, whether he was just such a visionary. This portrait is particularly telling because he's holding a device called a nocturne, and that is what he would have used. We know he took a kind of astrolabe on his voyages to help him navigate. And so he's holding a device that gives credence to this particular depiction of Columbus. Now, there's other famous ones in other museums in Europe and the United States. And so it becomes a healthy argument of how we interpret and understand history. And I think I use it in that way.
Toward the end of the book, from the Star Wars movies, the objects that you have are R2-D2 and C-3PO. Right?
Yeah.
So that sort of opens the door for a look at our attitudes towards technology.
Well, if you think about, you know, think about Kubrick's movie and HAL, the computer that goes haywire. And if you think about robots and a lot of the scientific, you know, science fiction movies in the 1950s, and here comes these two characters. They're Abbott and Costello. They're Laurel and Hardy. They give robots personality. They make them humorous. They're a comedy thing. They make them more human, and I think it does show that change of technology.
We're talking with Richard Curran. He's the Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture at the Smithsonian, and his book is The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. Well, several of the objects featured in your book have ties to St. Louis or the area, so let's talk about those. Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, they camped out north of here, I guess about where the Missouri joins the Mississippi. I think Wood River Creek is up there. Some winter before they headed west and all the rest at the Corps of Discovery, right? And the object is a pocket compass that actually made the trip and made it back. One of the few items, I think, that made the entire trip.
Yes, it left here, I think, in May 1804 and came back to St. Louis in September 1806. It was originally made in Philadelphia. It cost about $5. And they took it. This is the compass that they used to get across the United States to discover, you know, Louisiana Territory and what lay far beyond. So when you think about it, you know, my wife as a teacher uses a replica of that compass for kids in her class and, you know, like fourth graders. And she uses it for them to try to navigate their way from one side of the school to the other. Now, it's daunting. And, you know, make a map that way. And when you realize that Lewis and Clark used this compass to make a map every mile of the way that charted the United States, it's an incredible object.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking, I know people that can't make it across town without their GPS. So how did they use this? How did they actually use this compass?
It was kind of a dead reckoning. So they took the directions. And then what they did, they were instructed by Jefferson and others that he had put together with them to chart their way to particular landmarks. And they went out with these sheets of almost graph paper. They were in one-inch squares. And so the idea was to chart that, chart direction, and then at a landmark, take a different reading of the compass. You know, say go 28 degrees this way, then at there, we're turning left, and the bend of the river goes this way in this direction at this degrees. So it was really every step using landmarks and compass readings that they did it.
And when we look at and examine that map today, and you have the map in the book also,
yes.
When you take a look at that today, how accurate were they?
They're very accurate. They're very accurate. It's incredible. Now, you do have with some of the, you know, changes in rivers because things change over time.
Right.
and they were using a number of landmarks, particularly in any riverine travel, you know, where you'd see a rock formation and so on. So some of that has changed over time. But by and large, the maps were very accurate, and they were tremendous improvement on what existed before.
Another object in your book that hits home with us here is the Spirit of St. Louis.
Very important in terms of flight. Obviously, you know, Lindbergh was, you know, he was after this prize. There was a prize offered. I think, if I recall, it was about $25,000, which in the, you know, 1920s was worth like $1 million. Lindbergh had come up, you know, really through the ranks in terms of, you know, working on show planes and other things and gaining those skills. And here he's the guy. He gets backing from backers in St. Louis, you know, no big corporation or government to back him. So the backers in St. Louis paid for the plane. He purchased in California, flew it from California to St. Louis, stopped here, went on to New York, and then did that hop over to Paris, where he went and he became a hero.
Go ahead.
Well, the plane is particularly important because in the aftermath, I mean, this was a, you know, he was a hero, celebrated as such, but the plane went on tour around the United States, even went to some other countries. And that's when flags were put on the cowling of the plane. But what happened is so many Americans, I think something like a quarter or a third of all Americans, got up close to that plane when it went on tour. And for many Americans, that helped establish the idea that plane travel was legitimate, safe, and had a future. So Lindbergh played a major role in the expansion of, you know, air transport industry.
Another object in your book, Chuck Berry's Gibson guitar.
Yeah, Maybelline.
Wasn't that like one of the first rock and roll hits, I guess?
Yeah. You know, I mean, he did, you know, Maybelline, Johnny B. Goode. In fact, I love the fact that Johnny B. Goode is actually one of the hits that is actually on the Voyager aircraft heading out into space probably forever. And so Chuck Berry has literally not only left the planet, he's left the solar system.
Back when I was in college, we used to go to Berry's Farm, which is a place, he lived there actually, mm-hmm. out around Wentzville, Missouri, I think. And you'd go there and they had a little area where they'd have a band and stuff. I don't know if you ever heard about that, but
no, I hadn't. But you know, the guitar is very important. And in the book, I have a discussion going back and forth, kind of between Elvis Presley and Berry, because you know the whole development of rock and roll.
And you get into the technology and the social issues of the time too, like about race and the younger generation mm-hmm. and all that,
which is very important. I mean, music has been an index for that. You know, certainly in the 50s and in the 60s, in terms of you know association with. You know, complacency, rebellion, social movements, civil rights, and so on. And, you know, Berry, I think, really brought forth the importance of the electric guitar, which becomes the signature, instrument of rock and roll. And it was Berry's, you know, his duck walk, his different, you know, he had the movement. He had the exuberance of youth. Of course, the irony was he was so much older than the youth he was playing for.
You make the point in your book, too, that sort of paved the way. He sort of paved the way for the Beatles.
Yes, very much. And they recognized that. I mean, you know, Lennon recognized that, and many artists recognized that Chuck Berry really was a pioneer.
And his guitar was a relatively recent gift to the Smithsonian.
Very much. We're building a new museum on the Mall next to the Washington Monument, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, scheduled to open up a few years from now. And we've drawn amazing, amazing collections, and Berry donated not only Maybelline, his guitar, but also his red Cadillac.
Wow. Two more items that have a connection here, the Mississippi Birdman Copper Plate and the Mercury Friendship 7.
Yeah, well, the Friendship 7, of course, got John Glenn into outer space to orbit the Earth. It helped the U.S. catch up or getting close to catching up to the Russians during the space race. And, you know, I mean, for us, really was both heroic on the part of Glenn, but also a triumph for American engineering, science, and so on during an era of the Cold War when we were afraid that the Russians would get too far ahead of us. Cahokia tells us about another world and this copper plate. The copper plate was found in the Etowah Mounds in Georgia, but many people believe that it was actually manufactured at Cahokia, which was the center of what we call Mississippian culture, somewhere about 1,000 to 1,200 A.D. Massive culture area that spanned from the Great Lakes down to the Gulf of Mexico. And these are the mound builders. And it was always thought that Native Americans and North American were pretty simple, lived pretty simple lives, did not develop the complex civilizations we see among the Inca, the Aztec, Maya, and so on. When this plate was found, it was so finely done in copper. We think it was smelted here in Cahokia, and really has an amazing depiction of almost a dancing, ritualistic, spiritual figure. The work was so fine that anthropologists at the Smithsonian were astounded. They thought it had come from another place. The fact that it came from here then really reformulated our ideas about Native Americans.
Do we know how or when it went from Cahokia to, did you say, Georgia?
Yeah, to Georgia. Well, there were a lot of trade items. We have a lot of documentation, and archaeologists have documented the movement of different artifacts and different goods among these mound cultures. So rather than people living in very isolated villages, Cahokia at that time, at that time was as big as London. I mean, it was a major city, and it drew people from hundreds of miles away. So you really had the notion of a kind of regional empire almost, quite sophisticated.
Other items in your book, there are just so many to choose from. One is the Hope Diamond, and you actually wrote a book about that earlier in your career.
Yes, I did, about 7 years ago.
Uh-huh. So let me just throw out a bunch here so people have an idea. There's Ben Franklin's walking stick, Sitting Bull's drawing book, Marian Anderson's mink coat, Andy Warhol's Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah. I think, they're all commentaries on our country's history. And again, I chose these objects because the objects are a way into understanding the wider history. Many people understand history as a bunch of names and dates. And I think when we use objects, it allows us to kind of interrogate who made it. Why did Warhol make Monroe the way he did? How did the Hope Diamond come into the national collections, and why? All of Benjamin Franklin saw cane. He gives it to his good friend George Washington. He said, this could have been the scepter of a king. Instead, it's a simple walking stick crowned by the cap of liberty. In that walking stick is an encapsulation of Franklin and Washington's idea of democracy for this country vis-a-vis European, kings and monarchs.
Do you have an object in the book that we haven't mentioned that maybe is a favorite for yours?
I'm partial to a few. I like, Woody Guthrie, This Land Is Your Land. We all grew up singing that. I think it's a great alternative national anthem. One of the objects that I'm particularly fond of is Neil Armstrong's spacesuit, and really for two separate reasons. One, because it allowed human beings to walk on the moon. What an amazing, and get back. What an amazing feat, really, of Americans to achieve that. But the second one is the interesting source of its development. When it was first designed, the spacesuits were designed to be fiberglass and aluminum, really a guy thing. Well, when they designed those first spacesuits, you couldn't walk in them. You couldn't bend. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin couldn't have walked on the moon. They open up a competition. Who wins the competition? International Latex Corporation, better known as Playtex. They knew about making bras and girdles. They knew about layers and flexibility. So as one wonderful commentator said, Neil Armstrong took a huge step for mankind and even a larger step for ladies' underwear. I kind of like that. That creativity came from an unexpected quarter.
It's really a fascinating book, and we should mention how beautiful the photographs, the images are in it. And so you really use these images to open the door for interesting backstories that we may not be familiar with.
Yeah, I think that's the idea. You can kind of think of it as a traveling exhibition of the Smithsonian. You get the image, you get a really great sense of the object, and you get, more than a caption of a photograph. You get a short storytelling essay that gives you an in and a connection to American history. So I think it's good for that reason. The other thing the Smithsonian is doing is digitizing, doing 3D scanning of all these things. So the idea is, we love people who go to Washington to see the museums, nothing like seeing the real thing up front. But what we hope in the future is you can take the objects in this book and you too can print out the Smithsonian treasures in your classroom through 3D printing.
The book is The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects. Richard Curran is our guest. He's the Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture at the Smithsonian Institution. And I was thinking 101 items, that's the tip of the iceberg. And with millions and millions of objects at the Smithsonian, you could have 101 sequels at least.
Well, yes. And, I was speaking to social studies teachers that were having their conference in St. Louis. People were asking about it. I said, well, get your students in every classroom and have them mail me at the Smithsonian and tell me what their 101 are.
There you go. Richard Curran, thank you so much for sharing your work with us today.
Well, thank you, Steve. Really enjoyed being here.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Coming up, the 12th annual Baby Blues Showcase, and the St. Louis band Brothers Lazaroff hold a unique musical celebration, the Hanukkah Hullabaloo. This is St. Louis Public Radio.